Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, my name is Megan Zimmerman, and I'd like to welcome you to Women on Wednesday. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all cell phones and pagers and stay in your seats quietly until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming. Our session today is titled Strength from Broken Places, Women Reconstruct a New Narrative in Post-Genocide Rwanda. During the summer of 2008, our presenter lived with and listened to Rwandan women who had experienced and lived through the 1994 Rwanda genocide that left 800,000 Tutsi and moderate Hutus dead in 100 days. She will discuss how Rwandan women courageously expose their wounds and scarred lives to allow us to see how they draw strength from broken places in order to make peace and promote reconciliation. Her research reveals that women's national and community-based organizing has charted new ways for peace in Rwanda. For us in the U.S., we have an opportunity to learn from the Rwandan experience in ways that perhaps will allow us to improve interactions in our own communities through organizing. Join us to learn what Rwandan women are doing to transform their communities from broken places to peaceful spaces. Our presenter today is Etta Matua-Kombo. She is an assistant professor of communication studies at St. Cloud State University. She holds a doctorate from the University of Wales, UK, a master's degree from City University London, and a BA from University of Nairobi, Kenya. Dr. Matua-Kombo teaches an area of interculture communication. Her research interests include peace communication initiatives in post-conflict societies, theory and practice of service learning, pedagogy and research, and promoting interracial relations, and African communication education and research. Dr. Matua-Kombo's current research on post-genocide Rwanda examines how Rwandan women dare to create theory from places of pain and struggle. She uses women's narratives, testimonies, and naming of their lives in post-genocide Rwanda to show how women are constructing a new narrative that disrupts the dominant narrative referred to as genocide ideology that the 1994 genocide perpetrators used to instill a hate campaign among Rwandans. Paying attention to women's words and actions allow us to learn new ways to chart theoretical structures about peace, reconciliation, and urgency of women's organizing through change. We are very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Dr. Matua-Kombo.
Good afternoon. Okay. Oh, it's so great to see all of you here. It is an honor for me to stand before you this afternoon. First, I want to thank Jane Olson, Director of Women's Center, for availing me this opportunity to share my research with all of you. My goal this afternoon is to share the new narrative that Rwandan women are reconstructing. Why do I call it a new narrative? Because it's a narrative that is different from the old narrative that many of us know from Omar and Wall's book, Rwanda Not So Innocent, when women became killers. And indeed, the genocide ideology that for a long time called for the termination of the Tutsis. As I conceptualize this new narrative, I am careful, very careful, not to claim to represent or speak for women of Rwanda. I stand before you to share their narratives, to share their lives in a sense that, in the sense in which they create theories that explain this new narrative for peace, forgiveness, and reconciliation. Let me begin by giving you some background information about my work. My first visit to Rwanda was in the summer of 2004. I spent 5 weeks in the country and had an opportunity to interact with government officials, women who are members of local and national women's organizations, people that work for international and local government organizations, non-government organizations, And the purpose of this trip 4 years ago or 5 years ago was to learn more about the causes of the 1994 genocide and what progress had been made in the country's reconciliation and reconstruction process. My second trip was this last summer. I stayed in Rwanda for 4 weeks, interviewing women who were involved in different peace-building initiatives. The purpose of my trip was to investigate women's role in peace-building, what women were doing to foster peace, justice, and reconciliation in a post-genocide society. My interviews with over 50 Rwandan women revealed a number of things. Most important, my research questions were answered through the rich data that I gathered through these women that I interviewed. However, as my research progressed and as I witnessed what the women were doing in different places, I could not help but ask the following questions. Where do women draw their strength? How can they be so focused on peace, justice, and reconciliation when they are victims of the violence of genocide, and at the same time, they were perpetrators of the violence in 1994? Oh my gosh. Hold on. Hold on. I mixed up my papers. Oh gosh, what a shame. Never mind. And one of my students, a bit, she guessed that this would happen if I'm not careful. And it's exactly happened. Just give me a moment. Okay. So they were, as I sought answers to my research questions, more questions began to arise, to emerge from the context that I was working. This presentation today answers only one question. I still have a lot of work to answer all the questions that emerge from the work. And the question is, where is the women's strength? How do Rwandan women dare create theory from locations of pain and struggle? It is this theory that explains the new narrative that I am going to share with you today. Let me briefly describe the context within which the women's narratives are created. 69% of 8 million Rwandans live below the poverty line. 55% over the age of 15 cannot read and write. 300,000 children were orphaned. There are 300,000 orphans. And the country, up to today, 15 years after the genocide, continue to find homes for these children. 15,000 of them have been adopted. 120,000 Rwandans are in prison waiting judgment in respect to their participation in the genocide. 20,000 have confessed and testified that they participated in the genocide. What are the other factors that show how women were impacted? In 100 days, as we all know, 800,000 people were killed, including Tutsis and a section of moderate Hutus. Among the dead were husbands, brothers, children, parents, relatives, friends, and neighbors of the women who survived to share their experiences with me. 600 women are in prison accused of being participants in the genocide. It's also true that the genocide impacted the women in different ways. There are very many women that are lonely, many women that are widows, many women that have lost their children, there are many that are infected with the HIV virus as a result of the rapes, the sexual violence that took place during the genocide. During the rapes, some women got pregnant, and they are mothers to children that were conceived through rape. Other women were, their private parts and other parts of their bodies were mutilated. How all this, how this violence has impacted the women is that a lot of them are very distrustful. They have lost trust. They are very fearful and suspicious. In all, the violence of the genocide left women deeply wounded, physically, mentally, and emotionally. So who is constructing this new narrative? My talk today draws from narratives of women that were victims of sexual violence. These are women who, in my view, exemplify the strength that holds the courage that propels Rwandans to draw peace and reconciliation roadmap for their country. Why am I sharing stories about this group of women? Because their experiences reveal what it takes to talk about how women in Rwanda find strength from broken places. Places of loneliness, places of illness, places of widowhood, places of loss of children, family, etc., etc. These circumstances that we who have not experienced the violence of genocide cannot fathom, but we can only learn from what women say about their experiences. The United Nations estimates that perpetrators of the genocide raped hundreds of thousands of women, including at least 250,000 of women who survived. In many cases, women were intentionally infected with HIV. At least 175,000 of these women are today HIV positive as a result of this intentional rape or infection. It's also estimated that there are at least 500,000 Rwandans living with HIV. In the summer, I was privileged to interview 12 women whose experiences are characteristic of the thousands of women who were sexually violated. These 12 women that I spoke to are HIV positive. One of the women, in addition to her emotional scars, was physically scarred. During the interview session, this woman had been sitting very quiet, and when it was her turn to talk, she unfolded, as we were having the discussion, she kept her hands around her chest. And when it was her turn to talk, she unfolded her hands and showed me the scars that had been inflicted by her attacker. Her fingers had been cut off, and she had a very big scar, and she also showed me another scar on her head. And she told me when this fellow raped her, he wanted to leave her for dead and cut her up with a machete, but she survived. These 12 women lived together in a residential area called the Village of Hope. This village houses 20 families, and it is an initiative of a non-governmental organization in Rwanda called the Rwanda Women Network, and they get their funding from international donors. My interviewees, again, these 12 women, did not seem keen on talking about the details of what happened, as much as they were interested in talking about what they have done and continue to do with their experience. They wanted to talk about how they have translated their pain to strength. And I sat there and just listened to what they had to do. Let me outline what demonstrates where ways in which women demonstrate strength from those broken places that I've mentioned. One of the things that is very clear is that the women are very willing to expose their wounds, to talk about sexual matters in public. In traditional cultural, African cultural settings, sexual matters are not talked about in public. Sexual matters are private. But these women decided to defy this cultural belief for the sake of getting their country moved forward to a different level of reconciliation and reconstruction. For example, they go out and participate in the local traditional courts called the Gachacha courts. And they are also actively participating in other socioeconomic and peace activities that offer them the opportunity to demonstrate their willingness to move forward with the national reconciliation and forgiveness process. It is also very clear from the women's words that their sense of organizing by way of pooling resources available to them, for example, giving each other support to positively live with this horrific experience, doing things to improve their conditions of living, for example, participating in different activities essential for their survival, make it possible for us to see their strength. They are very involved in income-generating activities where they make peace baskets, make clothes, and do other things that give them some money to survive. They are involved in subsistence farming. And one of the things that I learned from them is that their small-scale farming activities are very essential because they grow their own food in order to be on a very good diet because they need to stay healthy because of their HIV status. So they grow their own food and they recognize the fact that they need to be healthy, take care of the earth, and grow good stuff, get good stuff from their little farms that they have. They're also involved in HIV/AIDS education. They are trained by counselors from the village, and they go out communicating about different ways of preventing the spread of HIV. They're also involved in legal education. Professors from the National University of Rwanda School of Law are training these women on very basic legal education. Let me just share some of the things, you know, excerpts from the interviews that we had. Many bad things have happened to us. Gachacha is a place where we go and talk. We testify about what happened to us. If they say the truth, we forgive them. And the truth is, I mean, the reference to they is the people, is the men that raped them. And let me just say something about Gachacha courts. After the genocide, there were too many people that were involved in it. And the official legal system in Rwanda could not accommodate, the prisons could not accommodate getting everybody there. So the country had to go back to its traditional forms of reconciliation, which is the Gachacha courts, to get the communities to go there and the elders to deal with the people that had committed the crime. And that is where the Rwandan women go and talk about their experience. And they claim that Gachacha has helped them because it's part of their culture. They go and sit down and talk about their issues. One of the women said, despite of all the bad things, we are searching for peace. We want the world to know that we are doing what we are doing regardless of the bad things that happen to us. Village of Hope provides us the space to share our experience and to live. We are healing, but can never forget what happened to us. Another woman said, I am HIV positive, and yet I am making something for myself and others. I teach young men how to wear condoms, even though I'm a woman. For those of us who are positive, I teach them how to focus on eating good food. Village of Hope has taught me how to help others. I am a full person. My brothers, friends, who I had known for a long time, raped me because I was half Tutsi. But that's okay. For now, we feel free of our burdens of bitterness because we can forgive. Only God can punish. We have to forgive those who did bad to us. Another woman said, I have lost two brothers and nephews. I go and testify. I know the person who did it. How can I not forgive when this person is still my neighbor? He is a neighbor to my family members. We have forgiven those who hurt us because we want to live together peacefully and celebrate our families. Here at Village of Hope, we empower each other and mainly our children to live in harmony. We do this through different things. We dance, we sing, and we do different plays that make us happy. We are happy when we see our children growing up as Rwandans. We do not want them to grow up in the Rwanda that we grew up in. A little analysis of women, of these words by women. There's still the question again is, where do women draw their strength? You hear their words, and the same question comes up. Their responses reveal a number of factors that explain why Rwandan women are ready to forgive and move forward. And I have a couple of these factors that emerge from what they say. One of the most important thing to the women is their culture, the communalistic cultural values that emphasize strong family and community ties and harmony is what keeps women going. These cultural values have become the foundation of their organizational skills and guiding principles for unity and reconciliation. The women have made very decisive decisions to take control of their circumstances by forgiving their offenders for the betterment of their families, communities, and country. The women express that they experience the violence, they know the pain, and the decision to forgive rests solely on them. Women are actively involved in grassroots-based organizations that support activities for their survival. They are focused on survival, and that's all they want. It is also true that women demonstrate a very clear understanding of the fact that violence divided their country, and it's what also unites them. This acknowledgement of their reality is what enables them to put aside their bad experiences and create a new narrative of reconciliation. The women are also very clear about what they think about their government. I remember asking a question about, you know, I just said, what do you guys think? Of course, I didn't say, what do you guys think? I said, what do you think about the talk that your president is a dictator? And that is the talk. The Western world does not like President Kagame very much. They say, and human rights groups, they don't like him very much because they say he is not doing the right thing. And There were two answers that really stand out for me. One woman said, "We support our government. This government has saved us. We get the medicine for our sickness because our country is stable. If we were still in war, like the Congo, we would not be able to get the medicine that keeps us healthy. You would not be talking to us today." Another woman told me that she did not care what anybody said about their president because the president gave her a country. And she said, "I was born in Uganda. I spent 25 years of my youth in a country where I was called a foreigner, a country where I was a refugee. And if it was not for President Kagame, I would not have a country." And that's it. Having said this, I'm not suggesting in any way that women have forgotten what happened to them, even though the emphasis seems to be so much on forgiveness. What is clear is that to the women, it is about how they prioritize their survival, and more so the survival of their families, communities, and country. What lessons can we learn from these victims of sexual abuse, sexual violence? First and foremost is that their willingness to talk about sexual violence that was inflicted on them reveals their determination to unmask and challenge cultural values that continue to sanction gender-based violence in Africa and other parts of the world. As earlier noted, talking about sex, sexual issues in public is a taboo, but the women are using this, their decision to talk about sexual violence in public challenges this dominant ideology, cultural ideology. Most important is for us to see their courage to tell it as it is, because it has evoked, their willingness to talk has evoked critical dialogue among many different players in the world who are saying it is time to end impunity against women. For example, you know, a lot of academics, activists, human rights organizations, government officials, international and non-governmental organizations, United Nations, women victims themselves, among others, are saying it is about time we ended gender violence, sexual violence against women. And that is based on what Rwandan women are able to say. Their engagement, Rwandan women's engagement in this issue, has created the need for us to become aware of some realities that are very scary. For example, given the women's narratives in Rwanda, we are able to learn that women are the number one victims of war and conflict, and thus the need, and hence the need to bring an end to all forms of violence against women. It is also clear from women's experiences that we can see the social problems that are a consequence of sexual violence, notably HIV/AIDS. We know that HIV/AIDS is a condition that not only affects women as victims in terms of their health, but it also affects their ability to provide for their children, their families, and communities. Given the fact that the spread of AIDS is so much on the continent, it is important that we pay attention to how women are impacted, especially when we know that they are responsible for the 70% of agricultural labor, 60% of agricultural production and 80% of food production in the entire continent. Rwandan women, victims of sexual violence, also allow us to see the new ways of theorizing pain, forgiveness, peace, and reconciliation. In my view, women's interpretation of their experiences is an undertaking that propels a decolonizing agenda. This is an agenda that teaches those of us who did not experience or who have not experienced this violence, or those of us who were not at the place where this violence occurred, to be willing to welcome the women's interpretation of their experience in their own words and ways. It is not for us to stand there and start second-guessing them. We need to be able to take in and to learn from what we are hearing them say and be slow in interpreting their experiences through the Western eye. It is also true that the women recognize that it is this violence that will bring, that divided them and brings them together. And this understanding really helps us to see the unique contextual interpretation of genocide in terms of how the women have responded to it in a very unique way, a way that those of us who have never experienced it can ever imagine. Let me just read out something that confirms this. We know what violence is. We were where it occurred. We bear the scars. So when we say we have forgiven those who did us evil, we know that we do that and we really mean it. We live with them, fetch water from the same river, go to the same market and church. Our children go to the same school as their children. What are we supposed to do other than forgive and make sure we create a good environment for our children? And of course, these words reveal that we cannot universalize experiences. What is specific to a given experience or situation is just what it is. Hence, our dialogue, or whatever dialogue that follows after hearing about Rwandan women's experiences, should not be about proving them wrong or telling them what they should do to demand for their rights or justice. After all, rights and justice are relative in comparison to respect for human life, which is universal. Our dialogue should be about joining hands to raise a unified voice and taking action to challenge the structures of violence that put women in such unbearable circumstances. It is evident that Rwandan women have not victimized themselves whatsoever. Instead, they use their pain to bring peace, to bring positive social change and prosperity in their homes, communities, and country. Their resiliency and strength from broken places is what we cannot but commend. Rwandan women have sacrificed their own selves for survival of all Rwandans. It is a sacrifice that gives us the opportunity to celebrate their resistance and triumph. In conclusion, I want to say that Rwandan women have indeed reconstructed a new story in post-genocide Rwanda, and also a new story for us here in the United States. What is there for us who are here so many miles away from Rwanda is to ask ourselves this question. What does this experience mean to each one of us? Thank you very much. I'll take questions if there are any, or comments. Yes.
Yeah, I have two questions. The first one is the village hope that you talked about.
Yes. It is, first of all, it's the issue of funding is what is really critical in determining how those villages of hope are set. But it was the main donor is a Canadian foundation, a family that donates most of the money. And you can also, let me go to, you know, online and check Rwandan Women's Network. And that is the local NGO in Rwanda that runs the Village of Hope, and they give a list of people that help them. Yeah, I was in Kenya in March when the violence took place to run some workshops with journalists. And one of the things, I was interviewed by one of the local newspapers, and I really disagreed with the view that Kenyans were thinking their experience was similar to Rwanda. Yes, they could think that we don't want to get to Rwanda, but the historical context is very different. The experience in Kenya was just one of greed and poor governance that led to the violence that was there. Yes.
It's been there for generations.
Yeah. And there wasn't. The difference is that there was never an ideology, a genocide ideology, to terminate the Luos or the Kikuyus. That was really the big difference. What kept the two ethnic groups apart is politics since post-independence time. I did this summer, I also did a presentation to NGOs and agencies within United Nations at Action Aid, and I kind of shared ideas that we could learn from the Rwandan women's experience. I focus mainly on women, on what we could learn and what the Kenyan women movement could do to really revive the Kenyan Maendeleo ya Wanawake, the movement, which is dead now. Yeah. Other questions? Yes. Yes, there are, and so many people, as I noted earlier on, were involved in this violence. And one of the things that upsets Rwandans is the fact that the United Nations set up the ICTR, the International Criminal Tribunal Court, in a different country, Arusha, Tanzania. So they had to figure out how to deal with these issues, and the fact that there was so much going on, and the revival of the Gacaca courts was one way to address these issues. Yes, there are different categories of charges. You know, if you organized, like the woman minister who organized young men, university, Hutu university students to go and kill, or the one who was distributing condoms to go and asking soldiers go and rape women. Those ones, the highest charge of the genocide, and they are in a court in Arusha. And there are others that are in prisons in Rwanda, and then others that are walking the streets. And a recent documentary that CNN did, it showed that those rapists are still on the streets. And that is why the women had to find a different way to make the best of a bad situation, because they want just to create a community that gives them an imaginary safety amongst them and for their children. It's a very complicated situation. Very, very complicated. And when you hear the stories and you're in that country, it just gets more complicated and raises even different questions, like, what are we supposed to do? What interpretation am I supposed to give to this? And the Rwandans will tell you right away that it's working for us. Give us a break and back up. And I had that a lot of times. And for a researcher like me, it's sit down and reflect and look at different ways how we create knowledge. And, you know, and perhaps that's why I think this is just a way to decolonize how we know things and give people a break. If it's working, leave them alone. And they also reminded me that they can't understand why there are so many people who keep on going to interview them. And they ask, where were you when we cried for you? You didn't come. Now you are coming. Even 15 years later, you still come here to interview us. What for? So again, when you hear, you know, you hear something like that, you sit back. And for me as a teacher, I'm thinking of how do I use this knowledge to help my students not to be so quick to use their own positionalities to make generalizations or judgments or whatever it is. Indeed, it's a very complicated situation and just a fantastic place to learn about ourselves and about a lot of things about life. A bit share, and then I think... Mm-hmm. And nobody understands. Nobody understands. But what they say is, if you were at the place, that place where the violence took place, and you experienced it, you will forgive. That's what they told me. That's all I can say. Jane and Tammy. Okay, you'll come back to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, they reminded me. They asked me, oh, have you been to the memorial, the genocide memorial sites? I said, yes, you saw? Mm-hmm. So if that had happened to you, what would you do? I had no answer. And again, the emphasis is that place and the memory that it holds. Very scary memory. Very scary. Where you feel, oh gosh, if I don't do this, it might come back. And they're very scared of the thought that something might foil and evoke genocide again. And whatever they can do, they say, if there's anything that we can do so that it doesn't ever happen, we'll do it. There was a question at the back there, then we'll come. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it, one of the things, just even when you walk, I'll tell you a story. The woman professor that I work with, she told me one time she had to have her house painted, and the people that had to come and paint it were those rapists. You know, they come from prison and they have to go and do community work. And she was in the bedroom with two of them, showing them what she wanted done. And she stood there and thought, oh my gosh, where am I? In a bedroom with two rapists? Nothing is going to happen to me. And gosh, just think about that. She is now, she tells me, that's an example. We are now in control as women. I can order them around. There's no way they can rape me in my own bedroom and tell them, I want blue color there, red. And she's looking at them and she thinking, you are a rapist, but there's nothing you can do to me right now. Okay, Jane, and then back. It was just an advantage to them, because this is where the different players have picked up these issues and engage in very critical dialogue about sexual violence. It occurs, you know, it is there, and people are asking, how long are we going to see this occur? When I was there, there was a huge discussion about what was happening in Eastern Congo. And one of the women asked, for how long is this going to happen? We thought Rwanda was it. There needs to be more work. There needs to be more focus. And right now, United Nations High Commission for Refugees has set up a project on gender violence and training people on how to do that, becoming now a real priority. And